Professor Allen's Comics Reading Journal for the month of June 2018. Welcome to episode 37 of this podcast series. And the concept of the show is to just have a brief chat about what comics I've read since the last time we had one of these brief chats, which would make this pretty much the books I read during June. And since I'm on summer break, it'll be a little less brief than usual, if you know what I'm saying. These books are listed weekly in blog posts at eyesandearsblog.blogspot.com, and I regularly repost those on my Facebook and Twitter, so you can find those, but those posts are not exactly spoilers for this podcast, since those are just lists. And here, there's a little more review, a little more critique, a little more discussion. But first, a little feedback. Dr. Ange was glad that I liked the Doom miniseries that he sent my way. As he pointed out, he didn't go to evil medical school to be called Mr. Doom. Exactly, Doctor. Exactly. We heard from Nathaniel Wayne of the Council of Geeks. Enjoyed that latest episode. That Doom title sounded especially good, as it should, and it sounds like you'll have plenty to keep you busy across the summer. Geekily yours, Nathaniel Wayne. Doom be with you. And may Doom be with you, my friend. We heard from a new feedbacker and a pretty new listener, Jeremiah Jones Goldstein from comics.blog. Professor Allen, I listened to your Comics Reading Journal episode 36 yesterday and enjoyed it very much. I started listening to Relatively Geeky with the J.L. May episode. Yeah, we all apologize for that. And I had a good time with that one, so I thought I would try some other episodes. I've liked everything I've heard so far. I'm headed to a comic show in Uxbridge today, and have a couple more episodes queued up on the playlist. Talked about Quarterbins for a bit, and I'm pretty sure I've spoken about that bit of feedback over on that show. But he also included a comment specific to this show on a series we covered last month. I totally agree with you about Squadron Supreme. I picked it up as a set for a good price not too long ago and read the whole thing in one shot. While I did like it, it did not blow my skirt up, as they say, and I was surprised. I really thought it was going to be something bigger than what it was. The biggest problem I had was the way it ended. I thought it was very abrupt, with seemingly few consequences. The other thing that didn't work for me was that the plot of the story, what if superheroes tried to fix all the world's problems, seemed to become an afterthought. Aside from maybe the curing of cancer plotline, it seemed to be more about the normal drama between the different characters. It was more who loves who, or who feels guilty about this, that, or the other thing, than what the superheroes were doing for and to the world. The consequences of those actions and how they dealt with it. It was good, not great, but left me a little disappointed. Anyway, that's enough rambling. Keep up the good work. Well, thanks for writing in, JJG, and keep the rambling coming. Maybe that was part of my underlying issue with Squadron Supreme, that the main through line of the story changed every few issues. I agree with that assessment. Good, not great. Thanks for listening and for feedbacking. Jack Bone gave us the other side of the argument on the Squadron. Big fan of the Squadron Supreme. I'm probably not the first to say that the throwback style of the writing, that's not a bug, it's a feature. In exploring a story about superheroes taking over the world, it seems fair not to make them the proverbial bunch of a-holes, but the Bronze Age JLA with the best intentions. I missed that in the early 2000s Supreme Power version of the team. I don't want to accuse JMS of missing its significance, because he's a pretty candy storyteller. I'd say you've seen what there is to see in the book. Even in those pre-decompression days, the issue seemed stuffed to the point of overflowing. An ambitious plot and a year's worth of activity while introducing a new world and new characters, though admittedly not all new, means not many pages go by without a significant incident or an expression of a character's personality or history. I guess its modern-day comparison would be Astro City in that respect. I will admit that they didn't stick the landing. The ending may take the shine off the prior issues if they hadn't had enough time to sink into your brain on their own. Maybe down the road, if you feel like rereading it, he suggests, just pull down number 9 as a done-in-one story, or 7 and 8 as a two-parter, or 2 and 3 as a subplot coming to the fore. Thanks, Jack. Appreciate that advice. Good to hear from you on this. The more distance that goes by, the less disappointed I am in Squadron Supreme. Not that my opinion has changed, but the effect of the expectations have lessened. To put it in language I understand, the language I use at work, the language of grades, I give this story a B, maybe a B+, but I went in expecting an A+. And based on that, it came up short. I do plan to read it again in a few years, maybe with a different set of expectations. That might affect my impression. Although that ending, which I agree, they didn't stick, is going to keep it from improving in my mind a whole lot, I think. Retweets and likes and shares for that episode came from the aforementioned Dr. Ange, Luke Giaconetti, Sean from Secret Wars and Beyond, Robert Ludwig, Scott X, Sean Harity, Old School Ross, The Great Kansan, Gregor Rujo, Trennis Magnus, David Ace Gutierrez, Karen from Between the Pages, Pat Sampson, acomicbooksite.com, Mike from Justice's First Dawn, and Laurel at Mountain Flower One. And on to the books that I read last month. As I do on this show, I categorize the books that I read, and first are the issues I read specifically for podcasts. The homework books. Well, that's how we usually start this episodes, but in just a weird twist of fate, nothing actually fit into that category. So we move on to books I read for listening to podcasts. As I've said before, I finally caught up on Aaron Moss's Headcast network, all the different shows he does. And I happened to see for cheap some of the issues that he would be getting to on upcoming issues. So I read Checkmate 14, which Brother Head discussed on episode 36 of the Task Force X podcast. Pretty good book focusing on Black Thorn, who is actually a character I sort of think I dig. Enjoyable podcast episode. And Action Comics Annual 7 and Superman Man of Steel Annual 4. These are among the 25-cent books I've purchased over time to follow along with Michael Bailey and Jeffrey on From Crisis to Crisis. These were year one annuals that they recently covered. And from what podcasting's Michael Bailey is saying, more FCTC episodes are coming soon, and I look forward to digging back into those stacks of superbooks to follow along. And three podcast-adjacent books or podcast-related books. Back on Shortbox 58, Em and I talked about the comic book bestsellers list, and one of our themes was how few of the top-selling titles we've read. Well, thanks to the dollar bins at Half Price Books, I was able to snag a few of those issues from a top-selling series, Dark Knights Metal 1-3. And just by comic book osmosis, being a DC reader, and also listening to Ted Kilvington's Justice Trek podcast, I had a general idea of what was going on in this series. But it was still good to read them, to see how Batman got himself mixed up in a situation involving Nth Metal and a mystical portal into dark realms. This was not a bad start to the series. It did give me some more or deeper context for the crossover issues that I've read. Glad I was able to get these for cheap, and glad I was able to read them. And on to the new comics that we read right off the shelves. All of these are from DC, now branded as the DC Universe titles. Green Arrow Annual number 2. This is the last of the title that we're getting. It's a tie-in to No Justice, but to give the Benson sisters credit, there was one quick comment about that and then they got on to telling the story of this issue. And it was a pretty good adventure. One normal man, well, one normal man worth billions of dollars, going up against the machine to fight the fight he wants to fight, and succeeding. Green Lanterns, 47, 48, 49, and Annual 1. There's a little bit of catching up on that title. A lot of things are going on in these issues. We wrap up the story of Jess being trapped inside her past. This is the story in which John Constantine was brought in by Superman and the JLA to save the day. And he does, sort of, from a certain point of view. We also start a story in which Jess is on trial for something bad that may have happened during a brief period of time she has no recollection of. And Simon may be turning against her. And in the annual, we get a good story with unusual art, at least on Jess, way off character model. But you get that sometimes in annuals or other special stories. Simon and Jess and every lantern head to a distant planet to honor a fallen lantern, and things go off the rails pretty fast. And their trainer, Hal Jordan, is keeping track of their every move, which just adds to Jess's anxiety. After that, Jess is accused, with pretty good evidence, of killing a bunch of law enforcement folk, so they go on the run from the GL Corps, and Hal is sent to find them. The Hellblazer, 22, more of our Huntress Hellblazer team-up of craziness. I like that each of them has a worldview that they operate out of, and it makes sense to them. They're confident in that worldview. But this particular team-up has each of them maybe, just maybe questioning that, and maybe thinking that each other has something valuable to offer. Super Sons 22, this is the last issue of the volume, although a new title, Adventures of the Super Sons, is starting up soon, with at least the same writer, Pete Tomasi. So although this is ending, and with a pretty good final issue, with the boys saving the entire Justice League and pretty much the world, spoilers, we will be picking up the new stories, and I am looking forward to following the continuing bromantic adventures of Damian and John. Wonder Woman 46, 47, 48, and Annual 2, another title that we played a little catch-up on this last month. This is part of the Dark Gods storyline, still being written by James Robinson. Anyone with a religious faith of any kind has become violent, claiming something about the coming of the Dark Gods. And so after battling Cheetah, who had been possessed by the god Orzhkartaga earlier in the run, Dr. Ange's favorite gal, Supergirl, shows up. Rao is dead, Wonder Woman, and you're next. Issue 47 has a wonderful Supergirl and Wonder Woman cover by Jenny Frisson of them hanging out as buddies, eating ice cream. The insides of the issue, however, were just a little more fighty-fighty. 48 also has a Jenny Frisson alternate, adding Jessica Cruz and Hawkwoman to the mix. No ice cream cones, though. The Annual was an interesting book that, although tied into the Dark Gods, also served as a full one-off story featuring the Zamorons. The combination of Wonder Woman and an entire planet of women, well, mostly women, who believe in the power of love, made sense. And the Zamoron take on the Wonder Woman outfit, not too shabby, actually. Interesting storyline, interesting take on what gods are and how they operate in the modern DCU. I hope the storyline ends well, that this pretty good build-up does end up with a pretty good solution. But we should learn that next month, or maybe the month after, I suppose. And on to some general comic reading that I did from a recent $3 for $1 sale. And based on Luke Giaconetti's glowing endorsement of number one of this title, I picked up from Atlas Comics from 1975, John Target, Man Stalker, number two. That's, of course, Target spelled T-A-R-G-I-T-T, because like all spy and crime and PI stories, it helps to sort of have a gimmicky name. I'm looking at you, Mike Hammer and Thomas Magnum. Ms. Tree. Anyway, Target, the best undercover FBI man in the game, heads to Alaska to stop some pipeline sabotage. Fun story, all things continued, and to hear Luke talk about issue one, he did that back on Back to the Bins 269 from early 2017. Also, at the pretty good price of three for a dollar, I read The Spirit, number one. This is from the 2007 DC run by Darwin Cook and Jay Bone. I've read very little of the original Eisner stories, but obviously have heard good things about those and heard good things about this run as well. And this was a nice start to the series. One of the reasons I picked this up at all was that the first issue ended with those two magical words, the and end. They told a full, complete story, and it was a good one. I would consider picking more of these up if, of course, the price is right. Also read The Shadow, number one, from Dynamite by Garth Ennis. This one really captured both the spirit of the original, at least for me, and that means the radio dramas, but it also captured the spirit of a modern comic book in terms of how the story works and how it's told. Really good. Again, I may seek out more of those. And Justice Incorporated, The Avenger, number one. This is a Mark Waid take on the 30s pulp adventure type of story. I was less of a fan of this one, as it seemed a little too self-aware for me. It had so much Doc Savage stuff in it that I thought it was more almost parody than homage. I can't really put my finger on it, but reading this shortly after reading The Spirit and The Shadow, this was the one that came up short. And Beware, number five. This was an anthology of weird and horror stories. None were especially great. But the one with the mother seeking out blood brides for her vampire son, that one was creepy. And Torchwood, number one. This is from Titan Comics from 2016, written by John Barrowman and his sister Carol, who have collaborated on Torchwood novels before. This may well be a good start to the storyline World Without End, but as a single issue, it's a bit confusing and a bit muddled. If not for the characters involved, Captain Jack and Gwen and Reese, I would have had nothing to latch onto. But those characters were enough to pull me through. And Ms. Tree's 1950s 3D Crime Super Special. This is an anthology of crime stories with Ms. Michael Tree providing the framing sequence. Good stories. And more importantly, for a comic like this, pretty good 3D effects. Earlier in the year, I read the 2015 miniseries from Marvel, Weird World. Nathaniel Wayne's recent care package had an issue from the next volume, Weird World number 2 from 2016. And I know that this is not the precise case, but I like to think of these books as Marvel's version of Elseworlds, giving them a chance to tell wacky stories with wacky characters that don't have to worry about that little problematic thing we like to call continuity. In this series, we have Becca, who, while becoming stuck in Weird World, has somehow managed to become the squire to Gulita the Wizard Slayer. And to put it mildly, shenanigans have ensued. I mentioned a few episodes back that I read a bunch of Max Allen Collins' Quarry novels and was excited to see a new comic series based on them. So this month I read the latest issue, which I think is the final issue. It's certainly the final issue of this storyline. Quarry's War, number 4. We're done with the origin story of Quarry's life as a military sniper, and this issue takes place fully in the present. But Vietnam is not done with Quarry just yet. And this is taking place around 1973-74, so that's reasonable. Good story and a good ending. I don't know if Collins is planning any more comics featuring this character, but if he does, I'd probably check him out. I pulled a trade off the shelf, knowing that someone had sent it, but not remembering who. But when I opened up Pogo by Walt Kelly, Volume 6, I saw the notation on the inside cover, withdrawn from the Rhode Island School of Design Library. And I knew the contributor was Mark Sweeney from the ITG podcast and blog. This book contained about 8 months of daily newspaper strips from the early 1950s. Interesting stuff. Not all of the humor ages well, but there are a lot of puns, and I'm going to be honest, I love puns. There were references I didn't get, but there was an energy to it, and that I got, and an overall vibe that I appreciated. Glad I read it. Me and M and Mrs. Quarterbin attended Heroes Con in Charlotte, North Carolina in the middle of June over Father's Day weekend, and a number of us engaged in the classic geek tradition of the exchanging of the comics. And from that lovely stack of comics given to me by the lovely Paul Hicks of the lovely Waiting for Doom podcast were a range of books from recent and not so recent Free Comic Book Day events, including from 2002 Star Wars Tales, from 2003 Way of the Rat, from 2004 Marvel Age Spider-Man and Star Wars Clone Wars, and from 2006 Image Comics Future Shock. The Way of the Rat story was quite good, truth be told, but then again it was written by Chuck Dixon, and so that should not be a surprise. The Star Wars and Spider-Man ones told full stories, and that's a nice thing to find in a Free Comic Book Day book, especially one that's more than a decade old. The Clone Wars story was probably the second best after Way of the Rat. Em and I both bought some books at the con. Generally speaking, hers were expensive, like regular full price, and mine were cheap, like five for a buck. Now, among the ones that Em bought for full price was a benefit anthology for relief efforts for a 2011 tornado in Alabama. This was the 2012 book from 12 Gauge, Country Ass Whoopin'. It was eight short stories that took place in or near the South and often involved fisticuffs, or as we call them around here, consequences. Interesting read, and I don't know that if 6 years later the proceeds still go to that cause, but I do hope so. Like I said, Luke Giaconetti let me know where the five for a dollar books were, and I bought a bunch of those. You'll hear me talk about a lot of those in upcoming episodes, but for this one, I read Kolchak, The Frankenstein Agenda, number 3, which wrapped up this mini-series, and it was laid out well enough that I could tell what got us to this point of the series. It's about military experimentation and super soldier type of things. And those experiments, as they always seem to do, got a little out of hand. Now, I was flipping through the to-be-read stacks, and I saw two related books, one that I picked up from a $3 for $1 box, and one that was sent in by Jason Marcinette, who I also met at Heroes Con, fine fella, now of the YouTube show Comic Sans. So I read Detective Comics 579 and 671. That first was a story of the crime doctor, and by sheer coincidence, that was discussed on a recent Sunday episode on the Fire and Water Network. Rob Kelly had Dr. Ange on the show, because obviously the crime doctor, with that character, they were able to go in-depth with Dr. Ange because of his training and long career as a criminal. It was a Mike Barr, Norm Breyfogle story, and it was okay. I admit, with all that pedigree and reputation, I was hoping for more. 671 was a Chuck Dixon story from Night Quest, The Crusade era, with the Joker trying to direct a film about Batman. And although that is a strangely common trope in comic books, this one was solid as it took sort of a different take on that concept. And from a care package sent in by the great Clinton Robison of Coffee and Comics, I read Marvel Comics Presents 155. This was from 1994, and boy, was it the heart of the 90s. Because this anthology book featured Ghost Rider, Wolverine, War Machine, and Namorita of the New Warriors. There can be few books more 1990s than this. I like the Ghost Rider story the most. Namorita was okay, and the other two filled up space in the book. And also, sent in a while back by Sir Iowa's Joe, was Simpsons Classics magazine from fall 2007. The main story featured Sideshow Bob and runaway school buses and lots of Bart and Lisa shenanigans. The other main story was about Homer undergoing an experimental treatment to make him smart and therefore able to bond better with Lisa. But he realizes that that's not really who he is. And he has to make the choice to become himself again or keep this strong relationship with his daughter. It was a shockingly intense story. I have to say, this is way better than I expected. And I'm guessing better than most episodes of The Simpsons show from, say, the last 15 years or so. And I read two related books, one from the generous Canadian Rob Lance and one from Luke Giaconetti. And they were Cull the Conqueror No. 2 from 1971 and Cull the Conqueror No. 4 from the 1984 run. I've read a decent amount of Conan the last few years, and there are obviously some similarities between those characters, including both being created by Robert E. Howard. So if you think this is a knockoff, well, I guess sort of, but not really. These are both fun reads, a little more mystical and supernatural than Conan stories tended to be. I do think that's the main distinction between the two characters, the world of Cull versus Conan, at least in their original versions. But the types of stories, war, conquest, vengeance, they're definitely of a piece with what you might find in Conan. But they were solid reads. The book sent in by the generous Canadian Rob Lance of the Comic Connection store in Oakville, Ontario, included The Outlaw Kid, number 13 from 1973, which had three pretty good stories about Lance Temple, who seeks out frontier justice while trying to keep his identity safe from his blind father. Nothing earth-shattering here, but a trio of solid Western stories. The other kids' books I read, some from the generous Canadian, some from Michael Lane of Comics in the Golden Age, and some from the Dime Sales at World's Greatest Comics, include Archie Giant Series 250, 518, and 564, Archie Pals and Gals 183, Jughead 295, Walt Disney Comics and Stories, Volume 22, Number 11. The Inspector, 13. Sad Sack and the Sarge, 143. And Richie Rich Diamonds, 29 and 30. The Inspector was surprisingly strong. Five or six page stories, each with a crime to solve, and each with plenty of jokes. And that's not necessarily an easy thing to pull off. And Jughead is probably my favorite non-Archie character in that world, and he had some good moments in his books. I do want to talk about the Archie Giant series for a second, specifically the numbering, because I read on the same day issue 250 and issue 518. So I was expecting these to be a couple of decades apart, but the first one was from October 1976, and the second was from July 1982, less than 6 years later. So I did the math, 260 plus issues over 5 years. So of course, it must have gone weekly at some point. Except no, Comic Book DB notes that they skipped issues 252 to 451. No explanation, they just skipped 200 issues. Very strange. There is an old saying about being a radio personality that certainly also applies to being a podcaster, and that is that you go into this line of work for three reasons: to help your friends, to crush your enemies, and to get free stuff. I don't really have any enemies, and I hope I've helped my friends, but we all know that this show in particular is evidence of that final part, the getting of free stuff. Of course, that's mostly from lovely listeners, many of whose names you've heard over this very episode, or many past episodes. But also, and it's rare to be sure, but I also get approached by creators who offer a free copy of their comic in exchange for a review. And what I tell anyone who makes this offer is that I talk on this show about every comic I read, no matter how I feel about it, good, bad, or indifferent. I will be honest. And to be honest, after hearing that standard reply from me, there have been creators who have not followed up and have not sent me their comic to review. But when I gave that answer a few weeks ago to Sam Johnson, he was not fazed, and he sent me a PDF of Geek Girl, Volume 2, Number 1. This is the second four-part miniseries set in this world, and here's the publisher blurb. After Little Miss Popular, Ruby Kay landed a pair of power-inducing super-tech glasses from her college's resident brainiac. Ruby alienated the majority of her clique while klutzily trying to demonstrate her newfound abilities, accidentally knocking drinks over their expensive designer dresses, for example. Her BFF, Summer James, was into what Ruby could do now and pushed her into trying to be a superhero, jokily giving her the moniker Geek Girl, following her actions. In a desperate fight to save her city of Maine from mysterious new villain Lightning Storm, Ruby gave her all, and neither she nor Lightning Storm were left standing. Now, new crooks on the block, the League of Larcenists, look to grow in number and capitalize on the hole left behind by Lightning Storm. And in Ruby's absence, Summers picked up the glasses and taken on the mantle of Geek Girl. And those couple of paragraphs were all I needed to understand what was happening in this issue, which is part one of the new storyline, Crime War. The issue written by Johnson and drawn by Carlos Granata has our replacement Geek Girl and Pitbull trying to keep their town safe, despite Summer not really knowing the ins and outs of being a superhero. The action is fine and the overall story works, but my favorite part was a couple of quiet scenes that took place at the bedside of the comatose Ruby in her hospital room. The bickering between the friends, all late teenage girls, all of that seemed legitimate, or at least seemed believable, and gave a quick insight into a bunch of those characters, really quick. And that, I think, takes some skill as a writer. So I enjoyed this, I liked the world that was created, the characters that were given, and I'm curious to see where the series goes. Geek Girl number 1 is out now from Marcosia and available at www.geekgirlcomics.com and Comixology. Geek Girl number 2 will be out just a few days after this episode hits the feed. If I remember to do so, I'll put a link or two in the show notes on the blog post for this episode, where you can learn more or purchase the book. All right, time to take a break here, and when we come back, it's time for another installment of our Doomtastic new feature.
The Vietnam War, a conflict that changed America. Of those who served, many came back irrevocably changed, while many did not come back at all. This is their story. Marvel Comics presents The Nom. Join me, Tom Panarese, for In Country, a podcast that covers Marvel Comics series The Nom. Each episode, I will recap and review one issue of the series, as well as provide historical context that's important to understanding the events behind the story. Along the way, I will also take a look at the movies, music, and literature surrounding the Vietnam War. New episodes are posted every 2 weeks at incountry.podomatic.com. You can find show notes and other media at popcultureaffidavit.com.
And we're back with the latest installment of our new segment for the show, inspired by a comment by podcasting's Michael Bailey. What we usually do in this segment is look at a piece of comic narrative featuring Dr. Doom from, of course, Doom's perspective, or as we call it here, the truth, without what Big Comic would have you believe, with their hashtag fake continuity. So let me welcome you back to Dr. Doom's Fireside Chat. But this time, we're not looking at comic books featuring Dr. Doom. For one thing, Doom very much appreciated the praise heaped upon his 2000 miniseries that we covered last year. As a matter of fact, on Facebook, that comic's historian, Chuck Dixon, also liked the episode, so I decided not to rush into another storyline just yet. Next episode, maybe, but not right now. But for this segment, I do have some Doom stories to tell. Because at Heroes Con, which we've mentioned earlier in this episode, I brought with me an empty sketchbook. Now, for more details on the whole of Heroes Con, listen to episode 59 of Shortbox Showcase. That episode is probably the next thing to hit the feed after this episode. Anyway, this was my first foray into original art, something I finally decided to do after hearing many people mention their themed sketchbooks. And obviously I thought that The Good Doctor was the only appropriate topic for my sketchbook. I kept the first 10 or 12 pages rubber banded together to keep them unused. I'm not sure what I want to do with those pages at the front of the sketchbook, but they are still available for some future use. But the plan for the con was to get as many sketches as possible in the 2 days that we would be attending, Friday and Saturday. So I started with fellow podcaster Jared Albrick, a.k.a. The Yard Sale Artist. Em and I found him early in the day on Friday, again the first day of the con. Now, I'd contacted Jared beforehand, and he knew this was coming. The funny thing was that I didn't actually see his sketch until long after it was finished, because I was standing in line, probably waiting to talk to Rags Morales, and Em came up to me, you know, 3-4 hours later, and told me that Jared was done. So Em went and picked up that sketch and took it to artist number 2, who we had met earlier in the day. And that second artist was Michelle Fife, creator of the series Copra, and past guest on many episodes on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. By the time I got out of my line, Em and I had decided to call it a day. We checked back in on Michelle, and he was not quite done with the sketch, so we told him we'd check in first thing the next day. So, to summarize, in my first day at the con, I theoretically had 2 sketches that were done, or at least in process, and I had yet to see either one. Now, in their wanderings around the con floor, Emmett picked up some cards from artists as potential candidates for day 2. We were looking for less established artists, maybe earlier in their career. That's code for cheaper, by the way. We were also trying to get at least one sketch in a different style. Maybe something with a cartoony vibe or a little manga-ish, something like that. So on the second day, which again for us was our last day at the con, Em and I started with Fife, and then we were going to go about, do our own stuff for a while. And Michelle was done, and man, he did a great job. I wasn't expecting color. I don't know if we had specified that. But we were certainly pleased to get a color version. And there were a couple cool things about Michelle's piece. Some things that made it stand out. It was not centered, which was an interesting choice. Doom's face is off-center, more on the right side of the page. But what that did was give Michelle the whole other side of the page, to give him plenty of space to swoop the cloak out to that side. So the whole thing had an interesting asymmetry to it. I ended up with 4 items that were in color, and Michelle went with a slightly lighter color palette that again also made it stand out. The green was a little lighter on the cloak and cape. The silver of the faceplate a little bit lighter, not as much black. So he had made some really interesting choices all the way around. So we thanked him profusely, and then me and him split up for a bit. I found a place to sit down so I could look at Jared's sketch, which I hadn't seen yet, but which M had seen the day before. Jared showed the most Doom of any of the artists, showing him from the waist up. This gave us a great crossing of the arms over his chest, and made him overall pretty darn intimidating. There's a nice purple and blue background behind him, which was a marker technique that, if I understood right, was pretty new to him. Excellent work, Jared. And just wandering around, I happened to stumble upon an inexpensive sketch guy without a line, which was a major selling point for me, inexpensive and no line. And this guy, whose name I did not catch, and I feel really bad about that. He did a really nice black and white sketch of Doom, nicely shaded and all around. Again, really solid work. Now, at this point, it was approaching noon, and I wanted to get the book dropped off somewhere before lunch. And M had reminded me at this point that there was also a deal that one place had about making buttons. What they did was distribute a small, I don't know, maybe 3x3 or 4x4 sheet of paper with a big circle, a couple inches across, and a few smaller circles. And the deal was, if you got someone to draw a sketch in one of those circles for a few bucks, they would turn that drawing into a button. So he dropped the sketchbook off at the Faith and Fandom table, which was offering cheap sketches. And of course, we chatted with them to network for Dorkness to Light. And then for the button, I wanted to go here with something lighter, something, again, more in that cartoony manga style. And we found someone, Jen Lee Conklin, and she was excited to do something that was different for her. So with those two items dropped off, the sketch pad and the little button template, Em and I headed out to lunch, and when we came back an hour plus later, both sketches were almost done. Jen ended up knocking out that button sketch first, and it is awesome. It is definitely Doom, and it's definitely a lighter style drawn with a bit of a sense of humor. And it turned into an awesome button. Everyone we showed it to was impressed. And then Vince, the artist at the Faith and Fandom booth, knocked out his sketch, a color headshot. Excellent work on the faceplate, on the mask. Again, another solid sketch. And then we were here with a couple hours left, and I was pretty cautious about getting another sketch because of the time frame. Anybody who had a line worried me for the risk of the artist not completing it and not getting the sketchbook back to me, because we were not coming back to the con the next day. So if we were going to get more, it needed to be someone with no line, someone who promised a fast sketch. Enter Juan Navarro and his 10-minute sketch for $10 sign. As I explained to him, you know, the concept of the sketchbook, he took a quick flip through it and said, "Whoa, is that Michel Fifet?" I confirmed that it was, and Juan said, "Oh, so I got to up my game." So I wasn't taking any risks, so I stayed and watched him sketch. And this was the only artist who I watched work, and it was fascinating. I have no skills in that area at all, despite being left-handed. And watching Navarro work was really interesting. We also talked about how awesome Dr. Doom was, whether that was real fandom on his case or just good customer service, I don't know. But he certainly delivered an excellent sketch. Just between us, he spent more like 15, almost 20 minutes on it. And you can tell. It's a pencil sketch from mid-torso up. And of all the six pieces I got, I think this is the most intimidating. Doom has the cloak just fall straight down. You don't see his arms, which makes him, to be honest, look a bit Dracula-ish, if you can visualize that. And his eyes and the mouthpiece, terrifying. Love it. So the plan is to post pictures of all of these pictures in a gallery post on the blog that will be there as soon as this episode comes out. You'll probably have to scroll back one entry and you'll be able to see all of the pictures. Also, links to the artists will, fingers crossed, also be on that blog post. I say fingers crossed because it depends on whether I remember to do that or not. Again, to everybody, really beautiful work. I appreciate all the artists who participated in this effort, and I hope to get many more sketches as the years pass. Again, thanks, and to all the artists, I wish a hearty Hail Doom!
Hey there! My name's Nathaniel, and I'm here to tell you about an exciting new podcast.
What are you doing?
Oh, hey, Liz. I'm just recording the podcast promo.
You're recording the promo for the Punch Like a Girl podcast?
Yeah.
You.
Yeah, I'm one of the hosts. I have more podcast experience. What?
You're going to sit there and mansplain to people about a podcast focusing on graphic novels and trade collections with female protagonists?
Oh.
Yeah.
Can I at least tell them how it's available on iTunes and Stitcher and at punchlikeagirlpod.wordpress.com?
No.
Shoot. All right, well, hang on. I'll delete this. We'll try again.
That's not delete. That's the button for publish.
And we're back, again, to talk about the graphic novels, trade paperback collections, miniseries, and long runs that I read in June. I mentioned last month that I read Action Comics 1000, and that spurred me on to grab the big companion book, Action Comics 80 Years of Superman. It was a nice mix of brief text pieces and important historical stories. Full issues included in that book were Action Comics 285, 484, 554, 584, 662, and Zero, that last one from the New 52. These include the story where Supergirl is allowed to go public by her overbearing cousin. I've read it before, but I've probably heard multiple podcasters talk about it since the last time I read it, and it's actually not a bad little story. And there's the one where the Earth 2, Clark, married Lois. That was a fun one, too. The one where he revealed his Superman identity to Lois in the good old John Byrne take on Earth 1. That was there, too. Parts of lots of other issues were in here, too, including a Human Target backup story. That was a nice touch, actually, speaking to the fact that although Superman dominates and anchors the history of Action Comics, there were various backup features that appeared at times in the book's history. Not a bad collection, although, you know I have to go here, that list price was pretty high, maybe higher than the book deserved. With the Infinity War movie out, that reminded me that I had some Infinity Gauntlet crossovers in the reading pile, and I figured that there would be no better time for reading them than now, so I read Doctor Strange 35, Silver Surfer 59, and Sleepwalker 7. I'd covered the prior two Doctor Strange issues 33 and 34 on Quarter Bins a few years back, and at that time I wasn't all that impressed. But these ones seemed to move the plot further a little bit, and more fully reflect the implication of the snapping of Thanos' fingers. Doctor Strange 35 was especially strong, with Thanos being on the team of good guys, as Nebula has the gauntlet now, and everybody is afraid of what that could mean. I also liked the Silver Surfer issue because the all-star superpower team of Awesome, assembled to take down Nebula, includes Thanos, Doc Strange, Warlock, the Surfer, and appropriately, Dr. Doom. Anytime the recognition is given that he belongs on that level, that he deserves that status, is a good day. For a fuller discussion of Sleepwalker 7, Chris Tyler, the hair metal hero and longtime friend of Relatively Geeky and the biggest fan I know of Sleepwalker, discussed that issue as a run-up to the movie on Back to the Bins 322. In my semi-regular rearranging of the comic stacks, the to-be-read pile, or as the great Cantons and Gregor Rujo calls it, the never-ending reading pile, I found a series of books that I had purchased to follow along with the Tales of the Justice Society podcast, which unfortunately hasn't released an episode in 3 years, so I took the bold decision to just go ahead and read All-Star Squadron 47 through 51. DC was rolling here. A couple of these are Crisis tie-ins. You've got some early Todd McFarlane work as well. And the issues feature such characters as Dr. Fate, Shining Knight, Blackhawk. It's a really good series, underrated, I think, and maybe even forgotten. I've mentioned this fact more than once, much to the chagrin of some listeners, and that is that I don't really dig the Hulk a whole lot. but after liking a story of his in the magazine that I covered for Quarterbin 119, which makes me realize I could have put this section in the podcast adjacent category earlier in the episode. Anyway, it's too late for that. I dug through the reading pile and found these issues from the character and thought I'd give him a shot. A couple of these were totally falling apart. Thank you, generous Canadian Rob Lance. And one I picked up for a whole bright, shiny quarter. So I read The Incredible Hulk 105, 108, and 256. So we've got stuff here from the late 60s and the early 80s. And I think I like the Mantlow story in 256 the most. You've got General Talbot and the U.S. political stuff happening, and also Banner stows away on a ship that lands in Israel. So then you get a story about international politics as well. A story about a controversial political situation, but one that is handled with a level of even-handedness that I'd like to see brought to bear on political issues today. With nuance, with not picking sides, with just telling an enjoyable story. See, I can like Hulk stories sometimes. Now, when I talked about the Hulk on the Quarterbin, I mentioned that I was a fan of a particular member of his supporting cast, and when I looked through the $3 for $1 boxes recently, I learned that this fellow had a 5-issue miniseries back in 2006. But you know how cheap bins are, so of the 5-issue series, I bought and read Doc Samson 1 through, well, through 4. We've all been here, right? I like this, actually. It was loosely connected stories about Doc solving a variety of problems with his psychoanalytical skills and his willingness to deliver consequences when needed. We get a new scorpion, we get living totem poles, and various other craziness. I like a guy whose brain is his primary weapon, although he can deliver consequences, like I'd said. But the difference between Doc Samson and other science guys in the Marvel Universe is that Samson does just one thing. He uses psychology. Maybe it's because they consider that a soft science, as opposed to the Hank Pyms or Reed What's-His-Name, who, because those fellas are scientists, they know everything. But Leonard Samson is what PhDs actually are. He's a specialist. And at least in these issues, the fact, the nature of his specialty, it actually comes into play, and it does so often, it was a pretty good read. I mentioned before the $5 for $1 boxes at Heroes Con, and from there I picked up 75% of a 4-issue mini, and the right one was definitely missing. Because I read Femme Noir, The Dark City Diaries 1, 2, and 4. So I got the ending. This book by Christopher Mills and Joe Staton takes place on the rain-soaked streets of Nocturne City. It was a standard noirish pulp story for a few issues, and then went a totally different sci-fi-ish way at the end. And that switch took me by surprise, and it made for a fun twist. Good series overall. On a recent episode of Shortbox Showcase, I talked about looking into Alterna Comics, whose business plan involves putting out comics on cheap newsprint and passing those savings on to readers by pricing their books at, are you ready, $1.50. I guess that the generous Canadian Rob Lance heard that because his most recent care package included Mr. Crypt 2 and 3 from Alterna. This is the story of a friendly skeleton trying to do good and to be a hero. It was an all-ages book, and I really appreciated the sense of humor, the lightness to it. And I thought that Mr. Crypt himself was an engaging character. It was a good read, and it gives me more encouragement toward adding a book or two from that publisher to the pull list. I also read some from a series that I got an issue, a number one of, from Sir Martin of Grey a little while back. And then I found a few more of those in the $5 for $1 box. So I read Jack Staff 1, 5, and 6. an Image book from 2003 that ran 20 issues total. It's a weird book with some scratchy art, but a few interesting characters like Becky Burdock the Vampire, who's also a reporter. I'm not certain that this guy, Jack Staff, actually qualifies as Britain's greatest hero, as the cover proclaims, but the book is trying to do something bold. To my taste, it doesn't always get there, but I recognize that it's trying something. Also at Heroes Con, the kind Luke Giaconetti gave me some books, including some from a recent Valiant series, Exo Manowar 11 through 13. I read a few of these way back in the day, but they didn't grab me. These issues, though, written by Matt Kent, were all pretty good. We've got Eric, who's just become the planet's emperor, and some of the people aren't so glad about that, including a few in his cabinet. It's an interesting sci-fi type of story, and a pretty well-told one at that. All of these three issues, the stories started on the inside front cover. They use that space as the first page. And that's a pretty cool feature. It's like you're getting more story, even though I assume they're just moving some ad to another spot in the issue. But still, it felt like you were getting an extra page of story. And from the three for a dollar boxes, I picked up coverless copies of Showcase 94 through 96. This was the late 70s reboot of the title, which also rebooted the Doom Patrol. This series gave Cliff Steele a more modern Robot Man body, and that design still holds up pretty well 40 years later to my eyes. We also got Arani as Celsius, Val Vostok as Negative Woman, and Tempest. I read these around the time they came out back in the day and really enjoyed them, so it was fun to revisit them, and the fact that the books were pretty much falling apart as I did so, that just added to the nostalgia. I recently read some old comics based on classic movies and TV shows from Gold Key, Dell, Topps, and Whitman. I know that I bought at least one of these from recent cheap sales. The Great Cans and Gregor Rujo sent in at least one, and the others may well have been sent in by miscellaneous various lovely listeners. And those classic movie and TV reads were The Underwater City, X-Files Annual 1, Twilight Zone 20 and 53, and Star Trek 39. These were generally fun reads, although many of the Twilight Zone stories lacked a bit of, how would we call it, Twilight Zone-ishness, if you know what I mean. But the ones that nailed that vibe, nailed it really well. The Star Trek one is worth mentioning because it struck me as quite non-Star Trek-y. Now, I, for one, am not a fan of the portrayal of the utopian Star Trek future. I just don't believe in it. I don't believe it's possible. To me, it doesn't even make sense. But that is what Star Trek is. But this one portrayed something counter to that, I think, about a peacenik type of guru preaching love and disarmament, which I would think would be a Star Trek message, but he turns out to be the villain, and it's a good thing that Earth maintained its ability to wage war, let's just say that. So, strange story. I kind of liked it, but partly because it ran counter to what I expected a Star Trek story to be. I guess Roddenberry's connections to the comics was tenuous at best. And The Underwater City, this was a movie adaptation for a movie I'd never heard of, which was pretty interesting. It was a 1961 picture from Columbia, and the adaptation was pretty good, I suppose. It's just interesting what things get lost in the mists of time. And about 6 months ago, I read the first four issues of a miniseries, book sent in by Sir I Was Joe. I really like them, so when I saw the next two issues for cheap, I picked up The 12, 5 and 6. This is JMS, telling the story of a dozen heroes from the World War II era who had all been frozen and recently thawed out in the modern age. Some of these characters fit in, some don't get along well with each other, some really do. I was really enjoying this series and just the variety of types of reactions of the characters that are present in the series. The generous Canadian Rob Lance from the Comic Connection store in Oakville, Ontario, always sends the most eclectic group of comics. And from a care package of his, three issues of a classic jungle character, Jungle Jim, created by Alex Raymond. So I read Jungle Jim number 22 from Charlton and the official Jungle Jim number 8 and annual 1. Those later ones were published in 1989, but were just reprints of newspaper strips from the late 30s and early 40s. This is presented as a knockoff of Tarzan, but it's different enough that I thought of it more of a more standard average jungle adventure story, which does mean that there are certain modern sensitivities that are not recognized, and the relationship slash romance aspects of the stories are, let's go with, shaky. But the adventure parts of the story, the river rapids, the cliff faces, all the dangerous bridges, all of that I found pretty fun. I am not sure at all where I got this next item from. If it was from a lovely listener, which it probably was, thank you. I'm talking about the Micronauts 2017 Annual, written by Cullen Bunn. This came from IDW. This, of course, is an odd property because the license for comics is actually pretty limited. It seems like every new publisher or licensee has to come up with a lot of their own supporting cast, or even basic backstory and storyline, what you can and can't use, why you have to develop yourself, why you have to develop stuff yourself. It makes each take, each version of the Micronauts a little different. And that being said, this was a good read. And I was able to mostly make sense of who was who and what was going on, despite not being familiar with this version of the property. Solid book. And I read a miniseries from 1987, another of the post-crisis reboots. My buddy Terry Colucci gave me the final issue, and I read the rest via the Hoopla digital app. This one was by Roy and Dan Thomas and Tom Mandrake, and they were taking on Captain Marvel in Shazam! The New Beginning 1 through 4. It's a tough mix to get right. The optimism, the light tone of Billy Batson, and the grim and gritty world of post-crisis DC. But the Thomases did a pretty good job maintaining that balance, but it's tough. And I just don't know if the character fits in as an everyday part of modern comics as much as I'd like him to. So I don't just know what to make of him. On a related note, I saw that I had a book in the pile from about 10 years later, 1995, that Sir Iowa's Joe had sent in. So I read The Power of Shazam, number 5, written by Jerry Ordway. I don't know if this is the same continuity that Marvel had rebooted, but this issue in particular focuses on Mary Marvel and her place in the family. And she has a vengeance thing going on. And we have a brief appearance by Blaze, because they were trying to coordinate all of the DC books at that time. And one vast improvement that this book had over the New Beginning miniseries was that this one had a version of Talking Tawny. And that is always good. Also on the Hoopla app, I was looking for that issue of the Quarry series by Max Allen Collins. So I ended up just poking around in the crime category and ended up reading Normandy Gold 1 through 5, a hard case crime series from Titan Comics, written by Megan Abbott and Allison Graylin. Normandy is a tough sheriff, and when her sister is found brutally murdered, she dives into the seedy world of 1970s Washington, D.C. Not just the swampiness, the politics, although that is there too, but we also get prostitution and violence and conspiracy. This was a rough, rough story, and it worked. It held together. Plot worked, the lead character was strong, but it was a bit rough for my delicate sensitivities. I think I like noir and more like classic PI stories a bit more than the down and dirty, hard crime style of story. Also on Hoopla, I read a series that I'd heard good things about, thought I'd check out. That was Hadrian's Wall, 1 through 8, from Kyle Higgins, Alex Siegel, and Rod Reese from Image, from 2016 and 2017. Hadrian's Wall is a space station, and when an astronaut dies, Simon Moore is tasked with finding the cause of death. But instead of just rubber stamping the notion that this was an accident, he instead actually investigates. The fact that the victim was the man Simon's wife had left him 4 years before and also shot him at one point back in the day, make him an odd choice for the job. And when his conclusions point to conspiracy, all fear that the long festering Cold War between Earth and Theta may be on the verge of heating up again. So in this series, we get sci-fi, rebellion, politics, and mystery all mixed up and presented in a pretty interesting way. And in the grand tradition of detective stories, our hero, Simon Moore, is deeply flawed to the point of having conversations with the dead man. The hallucinations are bad, but they're just one of the many, many problems facing Simon as he tries to solve the mystery and reconcile with his ex-wife to some extent. Oh, and avoid the destruction of Earth. I like sci-fi in my comics, and I like mystery in my comics. So a sci-fi mystery in my comics, that should work for me, and in this series, it pretty much does. I really enjoyed Hadrian's Wall. There's a lot going on in it, and it balances all of those things, mystery, sci-fi, war, in a very solid way. Also on Hoopla, I found the next volume in a series I read a little bit of last year, and that I surprisingly kind of liked. So I just went to the next volume, Grimm Fairy Tales 19 through 24. This one really explored Sela's origin story and the relationship with her arch nemesis using the tales of Snow White and Rose Red as the template. There's more to the stories than just that, although that is the focus. And it seems like more of that backstory is to come, and that's a good thing. I really like the way that this built up with the first dozen or so issues, just telling one-offs. Stories of Sela aiding someone, usually a woman, in the midst of a crisis and using a specific fairy tale as a guide. But she obviously had some power, some history, and that was hinted at in the last trade and then became the focus of this one. And that's a really nice way to handle backstory, to sprinkle it in, intrigue us by it, tease us with it, and then finally get to it. I do have to talk about the art because that's the controversial part of this series, maybe of every series from Zenoscope. The covers are by far the most risque or cheesecakey of the art. There's not nearly as much of that on the insides of the book. But I was worried that Volume 3 did crank that up a little bit, and I was hesitant. And both Sela and Melinda, they wear, let's just say, crazy outfits for their magical battles. But it didn't get past that line for me. My ongoing plan with this series is just to keep reading it for as long as I can, hoping that the art style continues to stay on this side of that line, even if it just is barely on this side of what I personally count as acceptable. And another Hoopla Archie find was Pep Digital number 10, Archie Schools Out. Seeing as school's out for me, it seemed that this collection would be an appropriate summer read, and it was fun. My favorite part was the recurring plot point of Principal Weatherby and the teachers being as excited for summer break as Archie and his team was. And there are a bunch of fun spins or takes on the Summer Day at the Beach storyline. These themed collections are a fun way to go, because you get so many different characters, so many different stories, that a theme like this is broad enough, and the cast of characters that Archie has available to them is deep enough, that you don't get a lot of repetition in plot or conflict. So another solid Archie read. And I think that's everything. In terms of my favorite read of the month, I really like the end of Super Sons. I like the wrap-up of Corey's War. Femme Noir was a fun read. The issues of The 12 that I read were excellent. But my favorite read combined two of my favorite genres, sci-fi and mystery, with an imperfect lead detective thrown in for good measure. I can't remember exactly what happened in each issue, so I'm not going to pick one. I'm just going to go with the whole of Hadrian's Wall as my favorite read of the month. Next month, I have a bunch of 2018 free comic book days to go through, and a lot of old Gold Key kids books also, both of those courtesy of Sir Rob Lance, the generous Canadian, and I'm sure that there will be a whole lot more stuff that I read as well. But rest assured, whatever I do end up reading in July, I'll talk about it here in an episode that ought to come out sometime in early August. Feel free to let me know what you think of this episode, what you think of any of the books that I mentioned, especially if you've read any of them. You can send that feedback via email to relativelygeeky@gmail.com or leave it as a comment on the Facebook or blog post for this episode. The blog is at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. You can follow the network on Twitter at relatively_geek. And, of course, the network has its own page on Facebook as well. Come join us. All are welcome. Thanks for listening, and keep the pages turning.